You have spent hours mapping out the third floor with no sign of an exit. As you are walking down a narrow, dark corridor, a stealthy goblin lunges at you from the shadows. Startled, you leap back. As his blade nears your skin, you duck and roll to the right. You stumble into the blackness of an unseen passageway. Wanting only to escape the bloodthirsty goblin, you run blindly forward until you see a light. Before you lies a strong door of an elvish design. In the ancient elvish script, it is written,
"Aliens in games."
Today on Doors and Dungeons, the gaming podcast, we're going to talk about ancient aliens in games.
Aliens.
My hair is standing up just saying it. Okay. And I am doing my hands while I'm saying that.
You kind of have to, yeah.
As is required. Spoilers.
Yeah, spoiler alert for anyone who's listening to this podcast. If you've never played one of these games, when you hear the name of the game, if you've never played it and you really, if you think remotely think you want to, just stop it right then.
Please.
Play the game.
Go away. Play it.
And then come back. Okay. You might be thinking to yourself, what are you talking about? Ancient aliens? What are we doing here? Okay. So if you do not know what ancient aliens is even means, what that's talking about, I'm going to give you a brief outline in a second, but the basic thing is, gee golly, there were aliens a whole long time ago that messed up our Earth and or made all of us humans. And this is a theme that is actually found a surprising amount of times in Japanese games, and that's what we're going to talk about today, because this was a fairly, not, I wouldn't say all of the time, but a fairly common trope among writers in the late 80s and early 90s in Japan, especially in games. And so we're going to discuss, you know, why that's a thing, how this sort of phenomenon came about, and also discuss the games that this shows up in, because some of them are the most interesting games of the period, at least in terms of storyline anyway. So to do that, we have me, Michelle, of course, and we also have our good friend Tom.
Hello!
And we also have Possicon Deacon.
Howdy. Yeah. And stuff. And I talk like this.
All right. I will just call Deacon for the rest of this thing. How about that? Okay. I did promise you a brief introduction to ancient aliens, so here it goes. I guess the best place to start would be 1968. A guy named Erich von Däniken. He wrote a book that in German, I don't know how to pronounce. In English, it was titled Chariots of the Gods. And the book was written in 68, and it came out in Japan in 74 with the title Mirai no Kyoku, which means Memories of the Future, which is actually the correct translation of the German. And that's kind of an odd title when you think about it, Memories of the Future. And it's this idea of like cyclical time, that a lot of the things that we know now are things that were happening in the past as well, kind of repeated themselves. And that history has this sort of record of it if you know where to look and know how to look. And the idea being that there's all kinds of places all over the world, ancient sites from anything from the pyramids to, you know, myths of Atlantis to stone monuments, Nazca. The Nazca lines, if you don't know what that is, it's in Peru. There's these huge, giant, like, what would you say, paintings, I guess you could say,
I guess, almost, in a way.
Etchings in the sand that have been, because there's no wind there, that have been preserved for thousands of years or more, that make pictures that you can only see if you're in the sky. And there's literally, I mean, there's no way you could possibly understand it from the ground. It looks like nothing from the ground. But when you're in the sky, it makes all these giant pictures. And the question is, well, who would that have been made for? Because no one's going to see it. And if you look around the world, there's just all these sites and monuments and all these synchronicities and things that seem to add up. Like, why are there pyramids in Egypt that have the exact same ratios as pyramids in places like South America, mm-hmm. Mexico, places like Southeast Asia and stuff like that? For example, here I've got this book, which is a Japanese book published by a company called Mu, which makes stuff like kind of cheap publishing things like, oh, look, here's all the alien stories we could find last year. And, you know, some, you know, farmer Yoshinoya out there in his rice field saying, I fell over in my rice, so an alien flew over my head, you know. But this company prints books about various paranormal topics. And I have one of them. This is just a book of O-parts, which O-parts stands for out of place objects. Sure. Or artifacts, yeah. Actually. Sorry, not objects. Out of place artifacts.
Opobjects.
Yes. Opobs. That sounds weird. Okay. Yeah, and it's things like there's this carving in Egypt on one of the temples that looks exactly like an Egyptian holding up a giant light bulb. It's got a coil in it. It's got a filament. It's got everything that you would expect for a light bulb to have, the right shape, everything. And, you know, people will say, oh, well, that's not what that is at all. It's just something else. But if you look at it, that's what it looks like. There's these little gold, little plain looking things that were found in Mexico, I think it was, or Peru. I think it was Peru, maybe, that are made of gold and they're shaped like modern airplanes. And they are aerodynamically sound. If you were to build them into a scale model and take them into a wind tunnel, they will fly. And it's like, well, how did they know this? How did they have this technology? And the idea behind this theory is that aliens came to Earth way back in ancient past and brought all this information and technology. And for whatever reason, they either influenced mankind or they created mankind. And there's this guy named Zachariah mm-hmm. Sitchin who came up with this theory that these gods called the Anunnaki came and they influenced mankind's evolution by genetically altering the whatever race of hominids or humanoids, or I guess you could say, is that were on the planet at the time, you know, genetically modifying them to make them intelligent thinking people.
Rather than have a missing link.
And as a general aside, if you want to know more about the Anunnaki, this isn't game related, but if you want to know more about the Anunnaki in pop culture, I recommend watching Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated, which heavily incorporates the Anunnaki.
Yes, that's true. In fact, they actually, I remember the episode where they pull out the book and were like, this has to do with Zachariah Sitchin. I'm like, what?
Wow. That show was ridiculously amazing.
Yeah, that was a well-written show, and it went places I did not expect it to go. But yeah, if you know what to look for, you can find these kinds of theories all throughout a lot of video games. And sometimes you don't even expect it, like the Moai statues. You know the Moai statues. It's those big giant stone heads that were in Easter Island, right?
Yep.
That's true. You've probably seen it even if you don't know the name. You can find them and the Sphinx and other stuff like that in Super Mario Land on the Game Boy and other things.
All over Gradius.
Exactly. And they were all over Japanese games at the time. And so there's all these games that have little elements of this theory interwoven in them. And the question is why? And it seems like an obvious question because it's cool, because it looks good. But the deeper question is, why did this theory hit Japan in a way that it became a part of pop culture in Japan when it really didn't in America and other places, even though this stuff was in English before it was in Japanese? And so that's what we want to explore.
So I think it's important to have a bit of context for why it would be popular outside of Japan first, just to get it out of the way. I will say that Von Däniken was not the only person putting forth theories.
Absolutely not.
He was putting forth the most popular theory about extraterrestrials coming in and influencing the history of the human species, the beginnings of civilization, and then on. I remember an example of this. with some archaeologists going through Sumerian artifacts, old literature, and records of Sumerian language itself, which was the first written and not vocally recorded, but the first written recorded language that we know of. And Sumerian language, in this weird tangent, I will say, is very, very different from its neighbors. Anything from Assyria, from Egypt, any of the Semitic languages, they're all very different from Sumerian, which seems to have an almost alien cadence and structure to it. And some people, you know, tangential to archaeology, or at least involved in criticizing the work of archaeologists and similar scholars, they would point to this theory, this idea, incredulous as it seems, that Sumerian language was an alien language or an alien influence language. And the more I think about this, the more I personally think that quite a few people would see this, oh, it's all aliens. They did this. Ancient aliens influenced humanity and made us, or put us on the track to who we would become. They see it as convenient. At the very least, if they're trying to gain brownie points in an academic field, you know, it's a way to buy time. In the long term, without sufficient evidence like what we have now about different species of early hominid in between each other, missing links, and so forth, without that evidence, it's much easier to blanket assume that some kind of external force had to have caused this jump. Like editing a video in mid-sequence. You know, wait, what's that? Where was all that? Oh, and they go from that.
Well, that's true. I would argue two things with that. One, I would say that it's not really, you would say that it makes, for a scholarly standpoint, it gives you a breathing room. It gives you time. But at the same time, it also gives you way more derision and ridicule than it possibly could be good for your career. I mean, even talking about some of this stuff ruins a lot of people's scholarly careers. It may make them money now that it's become a popular thing. But in the 70s, I think it would have been a death nail for your career.
Well, but I'm saying von Däniken and his kind, they were the role model for the Ken Hams of today, who...
Well, that's true. You know, but I mean, you also have to consider von Däniken got sued right after he wrote the book by a bunch of scholars who said, oh, this is junk, and you're, you know, we think you're purporting a lie. So
how did that go? I don't think I knew about that.
Well, it was... There was a few things. There was one, there was like some criticism, and then they decided to like look for similar research and then, you know, accuse him of plagiarism. And then some people said that some of the artifacts that he were in there were not actually real, blah, 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 blah. So they just basically tried to either sue and or just completely and totally discredit it, which whatever.
Yeah, it was an incredulous idea at the time, and it is now. And obviously, why would I believe that? There are more interesting answers out there. But for the purposes of fiction, it's different because it is interesting fiction.
Well, exactly.
Great idea. Too good of an idea.
And so that gets us to this point, which is that why did it catch on in Japan? I would argue faster than it did here. Well, I would say that, first of all, it hit Japan in the exact right time period. You said the Japanese version came out in 74. Is
that's
that right,
right,
Tom?
Yes.
Okay, if you look at what was going on in Japan compared to America around that time period in terms of fantasy and that kind of thing, you don't see, let's just say 74. Well, you could even take 68, which is when the English version came out, but we'll just take 74 as an example. I mean, Star Wars was not out yet. The sci-fi wave had not really hit America. Like, I think the biggest sci-fi that a lot of people would think of at that time period would have been 2001 A Space Odyssey, which actually does have some heavy ancient alien stuff in it, but a lot of it was stuff that was completely over the heads of most people watching the movie. Most people that watched that movie at that time period only remember Hal and the space scenes and didn't get or understand any of the stuff that happened after that, or why there was the scene with the monolith and a bunch of apes. Like, they didn't get any of that, you know?
It kind of shows the divide between public and niche understanding. So not as many people have read 2001 as a novel. I have.
Sure.
It does go into depth about who are behind the monolith, whereas the movie will lead over that and just have a bunch of interesting images you can think about.
But now if you compare that to Japan in the 70s, Japan in the 70s was full, I mean just absolutely full of pop culture references to aliens and alien invaders and things like this. And I would credit it to a lot to the rise of like the, I guess you could call it like the tokusatsu shows, the, you know, the hero shows and these kinds of things. And also even stuff like Godzilla and the kaiju shows. I mean, you've got stuff like on TV, you've got myriads of shows like Kamen Rider and Ultraman with all these giant aliens running around attacking everything.
Early Super Sentai.
Yeah, exactly. So there was tons of that stuff going on in Japan. And the idea of anything with aliens or space people coming to Earth was already in the cultural concept and had been for a good probably 10 years in Japan at that time when that book comes out. But also, when you think about it, 74, let's talk about the gap between 74 to around 84 when you start to see games coming out in Japan. If you think about that as sort of a growing period for the culture. Well, actually, I'll take an aside here. I went the other day, this is actually a couple months ago, I went down to a book off, which is a used bookstore in Japan, and I was looking to see if I could find Eric von Däniken's book because I was just curious, you know, what it looked like and see if I could find it. And so I went there and they typed it in. And they were kind of confused. They sent me to the wrong places a couple of times. But then they finally sent me to the right place and said, if we have it, it's going to be here. And when I got to that section, I was expecting to, you know, find it just kind of by itself randomly, whatever, you know, in the middle of something else. I was wrong. I didn't actually find it. But what I found was an entire wall of books on religion, spirituality, aliens, and paranormal topics. And it was a big section. And there was a lot of books that if you know anything about the ancient aliens stuff, you would know many of these books translated into Japanese. And these were not like brand new versions. These were, you know, original prints from when they were written in the 80s and the 90s. And so it became obvious to me that there was an interest at that time period enough for publishers to be translating these books and bringing them over to Japan. And I think it coincided really well with the interest that came over with games and computer games and also things like role-playing games like Dungeons and Dragons, Tunnels and Trolls, these kinds of things. These were coming over untranslated from America, and then Japanese people in the late 70s and early 80s were sitting there, you know, at their apartments trying to translate this stuff with paper dictionaries to try and figure out how to play these games. And it creates some of the well-known kind of myths and humor and of mistakes and things around gaming at the time in Japan. Early gaming comes from a lot of these poorly translated, you know, guides and so on to how these Western games worked. And so I think that combined with this wealth of information on this theory and also a lot of other pop culture going on around it made Japan a surprisingly fertile place for that idea.
I guess the vein that you've hit on here is that there was a literary subculture interested in a wide range of spiritual, pseudo-historical, and occult topics. Ancient aliens fallen into that, at least because it's adjacent. So you have these untranslated books coming over, and those who can read a little bit of English or whichever Latin alphabet language they're looking at, they think, hey.
Well, I would say that actually a lot of these books were actually translated to Japanese by professional companies. So it wasn't even like these were books that were done, you know, by hand translated. These were published in Japanese.
Yeah, looking up the Fontenegan book, it actually was published by Kadokawa Shoten, which is one of the biggest publishers in Japan.
Yeah, very significant.
Yeah. So these didn't need to be, you know, hand translated. These were mainstream publishers publishing this stuff.
But first, the people had to voice interest. They had to write into these publishing companies or into their periodicals saying, hey, this is something we really like to read in Japanese. We've only gotten basic summaries or gossip about it. It's in their topic you like, we're interested in it. We want to see what people across the world, you know, and especially in these places where we're doing business now, what do they think about gods, mythologies, cosmologies? What are their social religious practices? And it builds on that. And the people who have this interest, they themselves might have kids. They might be introducing to books and libraries. They might be introducing to different kinds of media. So you have this subculture that just grows and grows in the Von Daniken book that helps.
I think when you compare it to America, like comparing America where we think of games coming from and Japan where we think of games coming from, especially from the 80s up until now, the vast majority of games were either made in Japan or America. So you've got these two countries, and we're going to compare these two countries. And so when we're talking about games, you know, we have all that information. When we're talking about this theory, there's something that's interesting about it. This theory doesn't connect with Americans the way it would connect with Japanese people. And I think it's for a lot of reasons. But one of the ones that I think of is there's a certain cultural pride that would attach itself to this in Japan that would not attach itself to America. I mean, America's society is, what, 230-something years old?
Yeah, that's true.
It's not an old society. And, yeah, we're living in a place that's an old place. But when you look at a lot of the artifacts and things, most of what you find in this stuff is not in Northern America either. It's all in Southern America or Central America. Most of Northern America during that time was either, you know, covered up in ice, or it was just too cold or whatever. So there were not as many cultures in Northern America at that time. But then when you look at Japan, you can see that there's quite a number of things from Japan that you would find in these books. Like if I look at this Oparts book, right, of all these different artifacts, you hardly find anything that's from America, like actual like America. I found one that's from New Mexico, which is about as close to Central America as you can get for America.
Well, I do think it's also fair to note that although Northern America didn't have as much recorded history, there certainly was a lot going on with the Native Americans, and there's a particular Native American tribe. I can't remember the details, but they're bizarre. Like their language that they speak, which is unique to their tribe, is bizarrely close to Japanese. And people have been actually saying that there is like a strange connection between that tribe and Japan that no one has really been able to identify. And you hear about a lot of things like that too, with, you know, various, pockets of Northern America that have perhaps been settled much sooner than people realize by cultures that nobody even knew were in North America at the time.
Oh, and that's true. And that's certainly true. And I don't mean to say that there's nothing in North America that relates to this theory, but there is far, far less in North America that relates to this theory than there is in other countries. And most of it relates to indigenous peoples that the average American today doesn't have any real relationship to culturally. Yeah.
But even, I'll just get it out of the way, even American Indian nationalism is not the same as Japanese nationalism.
Well, that's true.
So the general kind of what counts as cultural identity for different tribes, different First Nations across North America, it's they're not going to focus on the big historic, what ifs, related to the Von Daniken theory and similar theories, the way it would be the case in Japan.
But when you look at Japan, right? Okay, so there's, aside from Shinto and Buddhism and all the other things, then the, you know, the old temples and everything, that if you go even older than that, you have the large stone monuments that are off of, you know, way down south, off of, I think it's off of Okinawa somewhere, that are believed by some to be an ancient temple or something off the shore of Japan. You've got the Dogu statues, which are one of the highlights of the whole, look at all these statues from around the world that looks like aliens wearing spacesuits. And Japan has quite a number of those, and they're really, really famous in this theory. So I think for Japanese people, there's a certain level of connection that they can draw to this theory that the average American is not going to feel the same level of connection with. Mm-hmm. Americans are going to think, huh, that's neat. I'd like to see one of those places, or it'd be cool to see something like that, but you know, whatever. But a Japanese person is going to look at it and say, oh, we have a copy of that statue in our school.
Yeah.
You know, like I went to an elementary school that had a display of copies of a lot of the different Jomon pottery statues, like the little dogu statues, right? Including the one that's the really famous one that's in the Ancient Aliens theory that looks like an astronaut with a spacesuit and a space helmet. So that's just like a normal part of their culture. Yeah. And I think for them, that was sort of a pride thing, like a certain, you know, we are a contributor to this. This is a part of our history. And so I would say that on some level, first of all, just being more open to sort of esoteric things, which is true of Japan. I mean, America is a fairly modern scientific culture and is less open to spirituality. And I don't mean religion, but I mean just...
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know that that's
Well, when you compare them to, like, say, Central Asia or, you know, or other parts of the world, like the level of spiritualism in America is just not
the same. That is true.
So my general assumption, the general assumption of some people I know, is that there are many different faiths, different occults, different esoteric orders, and different histories of how religion has faith, whether, you know, local, communal, or by large supported by society. Those are different. They all interact differently in Japan, in China, and in other East Asian countries on an individual level. So in America, you might have a big group of people, a focus group. Some of them are Christians. Some of them are Muslim. Some of them are Hindu. Some of them have Shinto faith that they inherited when they came over. They all generally believe in that a lot more strongly on an individual basis than one person in Japan might do so instead. Because when you're surrounded by so many different esoteric ideas, so many religious and spiritual customs, you know, rituals, going to shrines, doing things in schools, just as part of your friend group, you know, they take it for granted, and they also don't identify themselves personally, have that strong religious identity necessarily.
Well, personally, no, but culturally it is there. And I think that's the important key, is because I think also if you were someone in America who this was a really, really serious thing for, it would be somewhat offensive to turn it into a video game. But if you look at Japan, where it's kind of something that's kind of just part of the culture, and even, you know, in some way getting wrapped up into the popular culture, it's less sacred and more just
normal. It's interesting, but it is normal. They can expect that kind of thing.
So let's move away from the theory and actually go into some of the games. So let's list off just some of the games that we all think of that we that really show this off. I'd say let's start with the older stuff mm-hmm. first, if okay. we can.
Okay.
Well, on our list, I see we have a couple of older adventure games for Japanese personal computers. We have Falcom's Azteca 2, mm-hmm. Templo del Sol, Temple of the Sun.
Yes. Azteca 2 is also released in America as Tombs and Treasures on yes. the NES.
Oh, yeah.
That version was changed quite a bit from the original, quite a bit expanded, actually, and is probably the definitive mm-hmm. version of the game, even though it does have a few issues.
Depends, because it's not developed by Falcom, it's developed by Compile. Yeah. So it gets a little messy there. I will also offer from 1986 a NEC PC 9801 adventure side-scrolling adventure game called Relics, which is sort of a borderline case, but it is yeah. interesting in terms of how it displays von Danikenism and similar theories in a fictional context. And I will argue that.
Okay. And I had mentioned previously, it's again a bit more fringe, but there is the MSX title Ushas, which was released in the UK, I believe, as Treasure of Ushas. Yes. And that yes. doesn't entirely seem like it is related until the ending. It has sort of a shock ending that kind of connects things.
Well, I would say that if you know what to look for, you can spot it before mm-hmm. you get that far. But yes. And then, of course, moving on from that, as we go on a little bit more, we've also got a game for PC-98 that is most recently became a little bit famous. Evo. I guess, what are they calling it? Evo Zero? Is that what they're calling it? I think, I don't know. It's the Japanese title is...
46 oh, Okinawa.
I just call it 46 yeah. Okinen. It's like 46 billion. How I can't do Japanese Ichioku, numbers.
I always get confused. It's a big ass number. It's 46 big ass number. yeah.
46 million yeah. years ago. Okay.
Dating back to the formation of the Earth.
If you've ever played Evo on the Super Nintendo, it is the prequel, spiritual successor prequel, or spiritual prequel to that. It was the game they made first before they made Evo on the Super Nintendo. It's a sequel, but it's not a story sequel.
It is a prequel, and the SNES Super Famicom version arguably was a reimagining of the idea for the game.
Yeah, yeah, I would say that's a fair and way to put it. But the story's also
right after that. However, we have Star Tropics.
Yeah, which is one of my favorites. It's a game that was really important to me, and I did not see it coming. It was one of those plot twist games where I was like, wait, Ancient Aliens? What?
I still have yet to play Star Tropics. I have it. I have a copy of It and Zoda's Revenge, and I still have never actually played through them.
Spoilers!
Quite a good game.
I don't care.
Spoilers. I know Tom doesn't care about spoilers, but yeah, next one in our spoilers list here is mm-hmm. Illusion of Gaia.
That's a classic for sure.
That is a very classic game, and also it has an interesting take on this theory, which we'll get into a little bit later. There's one that I wanted to throw in that is also, I guess you could say, an interesting take, because it's not exactly Ancient Aliens in the way we would normally think of it, but it uses it. I would say it borrows the major theme of it, which is Chrono Trigger. Mm-hmm. And spoiler alert for anyone who's never played Chrono Trigger. Chrono Trigger involves a giant alien being coming to Earth and literally reshaping humanity on a genetic level in order to achieve its own goals, and also changing history.
Pretty wild.
Yep.
Yeah. Which is the same theory, but in a fictional Earth, the fictional, you know, timeline of events.
On the other hand, we have, for PC-98 again, because PC-98 games were around for a while, a game called Libros de Chilambalam, which was a traditional Japanese RPG developed by Right Stuff. We'll get to that later. The larger point being that it deals with ancient aliens as well, albeit now in North America during the late 1800s, or a fictional version of it, an alternate history. I will briefly mention, I don't know if we'll get to talking about it, but there were two other PC-98 games dealing with Eldritch Aliens having an influence on human history. These were both by Hummingbird Soft for the same system. They were called Laplace Noma and Paracelsus Nomaken, mm-hmm. Magic Sword of Paracelsus. And Laplace's demon which is a reference to, I believe, a philosophical argument. Lavasse's demon deals with eldritch beings in a mansion, and you have to survive exploring it. And it's developed by, I believe, Hitoshi Oneda was the designer. He was a luminary of the Japanese tabletop gaming community back then. Same goes with Magic Sword of Paracelsus in the same IP. So, interest in Cthulhu.
Now, that game, Lapis Nomal, was ported to other systems.
Yeah, there was the MSX title that I had briefly.
And it was also on PC Engine as well.
Yes.
On the subject of PC 98 games also ported to MSX and such, this is one that we actually talked about very briefly before the recording here, and none of us have actually played it enough to really say much, but I definitely know that Kagero Meikyu, which it's by Heartsoft, and it translates as Heat Haze Maze. That game is kind of, it has a bit of a Shin Megami Tensei vibe to it, but that game definitely deals with ancient aliens pretty heavily. It just, I'm not exactly sure to what extent, since I haven't played much of it, and neither of you guys, but that is another one.
Which is sad, because I have it as well.
I might as well list the games that are so borderline adjacent that they're not worth discussing in detail, but I feel like to mention them real quick on my side. There were a number of adventure games for the PC 88, just before the 98, simultaneous to the 98, by a developer named Soft Studio Wing, and they dealt with Japanese occult themes.
Oh yeah, I have a couple of those for MSX.
Yes. One of the later ones they made, which is a remake of a previous one earlier on, is called Destruction ALMZ. It's a PC 98 game about not necessarily extraterrestrial, but extraplanar beings from Japanese history. Not just their usual Onryo Yokai, but also more abstract philosophical entities coming to influence modern 1980s Japan and turn it into chaos. It plays into the similar kind of esotericism, occult appeal that these other games are channeling to some extent, but it's not quite good enough to qualify.
I have a game here that's called Dragon Soulseki, I think how it's pronounced. And I don't know very much about this one. It's also a PC 98 game. But the cover is five warriors overlooking Machu Picchu. And it comes with a mousepad-looking thing that's actually like a relic. How would I explain it? Like, it's got like all these different little runes on it, basically.
It looks like aliens.
Yeah, it does, actually kind of does look like something like you'd see from Ancient Aliens. And it has this little metal piece that comes with it that is a little like marker thing, and you slide it around, and if you point it to the right sun symbols, it will show you the right runes. And I think you have to use it in the game.
That sounds pretty rad.
Which is really
Ancient
cool.
Aliens as copy protection.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Exactly. Yeah.
Why not?
I should also bring up this isn't really relevant to the topic at hand because it's not a Japanese game, but I do think it's worth bringing up. There's a homebrew MSX game that was actually released, I think, 2 years ago, a Spanish-developed game called Children of the Night. It's actually for MSX and ColecoVision. There's also a ColecoVision port of it. I think it actually was developed for ColecoVision first, but that game stars Count Vlad Dracul, who has been awoken from his slumber in the time of the Nazis by Van Helsing himself in order to stop the ancient Egyptian god Sutek from returning from the cosmos to destroy the world.
And
he enlists the help of all of the other children of the night. So like Wolfman, Cthulhu, he basically enlists the help of all of these different people in order to stop Sutek. And Van Helsing has tapped into an alternate dimension that is the source of Count Vlad's power, which you can access through portals, and it's being monitored by an AI personality named Athraya that Van Helsing developed, because he's apparently a mad scientist now with computer skills. It's the most...
Well, don't give them
this is just at the beginning of the game. I mean, this game is ridiculous, but it is an It is an absolutely stupendous, like, Zelda-style action RPG. I highly recommend it, and it definitely deals with ancient aliens very heavily. The story is shockingly good, and if you ever get a chance to play it, highly recommend
it. You mentioned Sutek. Yes.
Yes, I was going to say. Sutek, the Destroyer. Yes. So, Possicon Deacon and I are both Doctor Who fans, and if you are a Doctor Who fan, or at least a classic Doctor Who fan, you will know of the awesome story from the Tom Baker era, Pyramids of Mars, in which the ancient Sutek, the evil destroyer of the Osirians, captured an ancient battle of aliens coming to Earth, hint, and was imprisoned on Mars. And it talks about, it briefly talks about how, like, these ancient aliens that were fighting all over the cosmos brought their war to Earth and influenced Egyptian culture. And so I was amused when I first got Children of the Night and flipped it open and saw Sutek, because, like, while that's a very slightly known version of the name of Set, it's not like a common one. So I had this feeling that the people who wrote Children of the Night knew what they were doing.
Oh, undoubtedly. Undoubtedly, they were inspired by Doctor Who. I mean, they have references in the game to a lot of classic sci-fi. They've got Star Trek references and things in there as well. So,
and then that is going to bring us on to two more that I want to talk about very briefly. One is a game which we're all around in time period here, which is Ease. Mm-hmm. And the Ease series, at first you think, well, that's not really Ancient Aliens. But in a way, it is, because if you look at Ease 1 and 2, and then you also especially look at Ease 6, it really connects very heavily to elements of the Ancient Aliens theory in a way that you wouldn't necessarily expect.
Yeah, Ease 4 as well.
And then, oh yeah, that's true, Ease 4 as well. And then lastly, the jewel of our conversation, I think, the game that best ties all of these together is La Mulana.
Yes, definitely.
Which is, I think a lot of people that are listening to this probably know it, because apparently it's speedrunner heaven, which I didn't know about when I started playing it, but then I also started playing it like years after everyone else did. But La Mulana is the game that made me decide to do this podcast episode.
La Mulana is one of my favorite homebrew games I've ever played, and is part of the reason I got into the MSX, because it was heavily inspired by Konami MSX games. And as a result, like, I really wanted to know more about the games that inspired it and bought my MSX. So I have La Mulana to thank for a lot of my current gaming library.
Congratulations, you two. I have never played La Mulana. You are free to spoil as much as you want.
Oh boy.
Actually, really? You are. Okay. I'm going to play it eventually. Don't worry.
There is a lot to spoil in La Mulana, because that game goes pretty deep.
I'm sure.
For someone who knows Ancient Aliens, though, I would say that actually a surprising amount of it is fairly readable. Mm-hmm. Like, you could predict a lot of what's going to happen in that game if you know a lot about the theory. If you don't, you're going to be like, what? But if you know a lot about it already, you're pretty well prepared for what a lot of the stuff that happened. Not all of it. I mean, there's one spoiler in particular that I found out before playing the game by accident. Thank you, Wikipedia. That turned out, you know, it's a big spoiler, but in a way it's not really. Because I don't think it would have blown my mind had it not been spoiled to me when I read it. I feel like if I'd have seen it in the game naturally, I would have just been like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Like, I don't think I would have been blown away by it. Like, I don't think it was like a huge twist, really, even though it is kind of like the major spoiler of the game. Tom knows what I'm talking
about. Well, that's the thing with La Mulana's story in general. I think the story in the game is absolutely brilliant, but it's not like a, you know, oh, shock, what a twist kind of story. It's very much a story that flows naturally and is all about research. You're reading a lot of tablets, you're piecing a lot of things together yourself, and you're slowly building this big picture.
Thank you. Okay, so now we're going to discuss some of these games kind of in depth, and we're going to start out with a game called Relics, and we mentioned that earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I picked up an MSX copy of it. I actually had a friend of mine pick it up for me. She was in a store in Osaka and sent me a picture of the MSX shelf and said, "Is there anything in here you're looking for?" And I noticed Relics was in there, and I had already gotten Relics 2 on the Famicom Disk System. I think it's Relics 2.
It's Relics Dark Fortress.
That's right. It's like it's a sequel, but it's not actually called Relics 2. A next game. I don't know if it's even technically a sequel. But anyway, I had gotten that before when I was in Hokkaido at a store called, what was it called? Like Hokkaido 1984 or something, or Game Shop 1984 or something like that. It's a really weird store. I actually have a video of that store on YouTube. So if you go to my YouTube channel, you can find that video. Check that out, because that store is really weird. And it was cool. But I bought that game there. And so then my friend sends me a picture of Relics on the MSX. And I'm like, ooh, I want that. And then when she gets it back here, I realize it's a tape game. And because it's a cassette tape game, it's just not worth the time it takes to load it. I think that game took like 15 minutes to load it into memory.
Yeah.
It was really bad.
Yeah, some MSX tape games are definitely a little long in the tooth that way.
Yeah. But so I have played it, though, on the PC. Was it 88 or 98? I think it was 88 that I played.
Okay, simple test. Did it have just single screens or did it scroll?
I believe it had single screens.
It was 88 because it had an alternate dimension called the PC-98, which wasn't that alternate.
Hardware scrolling? What?
Software scrolling. Relics first came out on the PC-98, and it had a kind of choppy but functional software scrolling. So you play the 88 version. So Relics is a side-scroller, first of all. Relics is a side-scroller, and
it's not a side-scroller like Mario side-scroller. It's kind of a two-thirds angle.
Kind of.
Yeah, but also you're controlling sort of a ghost, basically.
Yeah, and then you can inhabit the souls of, you can inhabit the bodies of, I guess, bad guys that you kill.
It's not that simple. But the basic premise is you're a ghost and you can possess the bodies of creatures and humanoids you come across.
Right.
When, as that creature or humanoid, you kill the other creature, your spirit then transfers to that body. So what you just killed, you now possess. If you get killed in that body, it's game over. You go back to the start. No continues.
But do you not get killed at the beginning of the game? I was thinking that you'd start out at the very beginning of the game not dead, and then you die, and then it starts doing the ghost stuff.
It's ambiguous. You start out as a ghost. There's no body. You don't see any body that you might possibly have come from. In the very intro of the game, if you're playing this in the 98 or MSX, 88, X1, it's all the same.
Mm.
You see ruins rise up from an ocean. It's very, placid at first, and then suddenly these ruins rise from the ocean, and then the awesome guitar theme music plays. And supposedly this theme music was composed by the Japanese vocal duo Crystal King. That's what they claim.
Mm.
That's a story in of itself. I gotta figure out more one day. But in 1986, this was a game where you started out seemingly as a ghost with no past history, no identity, no nothing. You have a clear avatar, and it's nothing. Okay, well, let's go to the right. Let's see what else is on the screen. You see all these critters, and you can possess them. Cool. What is this place? It is this big... These ruins are not your average ruins. They're Geiger-esque. They have weird paneling, tubing, texture all over them. They're monocolor, and they're vaguely alien. And this is where this theme of ancient aliens starts right in the background. Because you don't know it at first, but ancient aliens are part of the history of Relics. However, Relics itself is kind of a fantasy world that's got vestiges of ours, in addition to things that are bizarre, even by, I guess, Von Daniken standards.
Would you equate it to, say, like the Ridley Scott take on Ancient Aliens, which is sort of like the Prometheus / Aliens kind of thing?
To a certain extent. I think it may have more to do with, it may be more inspired by Greek and Vedic or Hindu cosmology in terms of, here are the different places that these characters eventually meet, take up in the order of how things started in the ruins, how they were maintained, how they were, if not deserted, then at least invaded and made into ruins. And now, at the present day, you, the ghost, are uncovering upon these ruins, which have now resurfaced from this ocean on an alien planet. A planet, you know, that seemingly is nothing but ocean. And there's life. It's not said if there was a time skip or anything, but when you get there, there are not just critters going around. There are little rabbits and hopping hunchbacks of some sort, yellow-colored. They look alien enough. You also have soldiers. You have the Marks soldiers, M-A-R-X, capitals, Marks. And they're not necessarily communists. I don't know if they are or not, but I know, right? They are an exploratory team. You can tell that they have a hierarchy. You have the grunts who are out guarding the edges of the ruins where you start. You have the captains further in who have better arms to fight with and more health. And you can inhabit their bodies. You can kill them either with swords or guns. Your gun has limited ammo, so don't run out or you're dead. Restart. It's a game where you have to piece by piece learn the insides, the ins and outs of these ruins and how to progress through them. Roughly, you can divide the game into three parts. There is the opening section, which is a few levels top and down, largely going rightward, where you're learning the basics of the game. You're learning to run, you're learning to kill the possessed bodies. You're learning to collect items by kneeling down and getting them. You come across, eventually, however, a third floor where a bunch of rooms are available. You can go inside, and there are these protective sarcophagi, almost Egyptian. And if you manage to open them, which isn't too hard, you get letters, you get notes, you get literature. And they're written in a cipher. They're written in runes. They're nothing like what you expect. They're actually broken English. Imagine if you were a Japanese player, even someone who might have known a bit of English back in the time, playing on PC 98. You come across a game that seemingly has no text. Suddenly it does, but it's graphic text, it's runes, it's nothing like Japanese or English. And you're not going to first think, oh, wait, is this English? Because, well, you can make out, you know, eventually you might make out T-H-E, the, za, right. Okay, the. But what's all this? The, of the, or whatever. So eventually people did figure out what this actually translated to. It's broken English. Very much a kind of Tower Turaga-esque trial and error process needed to figure out just how to interpret these notes.
Well, that doesn't sound fun. I mean, it does, but...
to certain people, it might be.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't need the notes to beat the game, but it helps a lot because it speeds up what would otherwise be trial and error. You need certain, you need to be a certain body at a certain time to progress a certain point into the game and to eventually beat it. The end goal is to eventually be the hero.
Ah, so it's a progression. Essentially, it's like a soul progression.
Kind of.
Well, that sounds really interesting. And I do think it actually is kind of a mix of like Vedic tradition with sort of a Ridley Scott horror alien-ish approach, like a Geiger-ish approach to the ancient alien concept, which is neat. Right. So then let's actually take that and move on to the next game, which is Usha's, Treasure of Usha's.
Usha's, which was released in the UK, I believe, as Treasure of Usha's. It's an MSX exclusive from Konami, actually, which there are very few of those. But yeah, it was just released as Usha's, spelled U-S with like a weird symbol-y thing under it, A-S. So just U-S-A-S. It was, however, then released for the MSX in the United Kingdom and I think other parts of Europe as Treasure of Ushas.
Mm. No, it's Treasure of USA's.
Yes, exactly. But no, the premise of the game is basically you're these two explorers named Wit and Kles, which are, I don't know what those nationalities are, but yeah, you're these two guys named Wit and Kles going around to four different ruins looking for the four gems of Ushas, which theoretically you can then combine together and insert into a statue at the shrine of Ushas. And you believe there's a treasure that will be unveiled by doing so.
For anyone who wants to play this, spoilers.
Yes, there are definitely spoilers coming. But yeah, the game itself is, it's an okay platformer. I think it's a little overrated, honestly. I like the music, I like the gameplay, and I like the concept.
I thought the music was great.
Yeah, the music is fantastic. But I think the level designs are terrible, especially when you get later into the game. They are designed to basically make you repeat areas over and over again by having pitfalls appear under you, or by having like death traps, or basically they're designed to waste your time toward the end of the game.
I noticed that when I was playing last night, even just in the first two levels, because I played them in the wrong order. Probably I played the right one first, which I guess is the second one, which is harder. And I got killed, and then I did the other one, and I got further in the first one. But I noticed a few things about it. First of all, to me, on all the games in this list, to me, Ushas is the one that looks the most like La Mulana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say so.
In terms of both like gameplay and in just style, aside from the bad level design, you could take any part of Ushas and take it out of that game and put it into the original version of La Mulana, and it would not look out of place.
Oh, yeah, no. Mm. Ushas is a beautiful-looking game. And again, conceptually, I think it's really good, too, because the basic premise of the game is you pick between either Wit or Kles. They have slightly different jump arcs, slightly different speeds, slightly different attacks, yeah. But then also, there are these icons you find in the stages that alter your emotion. And when your emotion is altered, it also changes the music and it changes your attacks slightly as well.
Yes. And also allows you to push boxes faster and stuff like that.
Yeah. Mm. Each emotion has a different effect on each character, and the boss room for each stage can only be opened if you are in a certain emotional state. So right. Like the boss of the first section, I believe, can only be opened if your emotional state is happy. And one of the key ways to play through the game, especially in the later stages, unfortunately, is to get the emotional state you need, open the boss door, but don't go through it. Instead, go back and collect a better emotional state that's better suited to fight the boss, and then backtrack all the way to the boss room and then fight the boss.
I guess they wanted to add some simulation elements and realized, hey, we could pad the game out using this. This is a great idea.
Yeah, but yeah, the ancient aliens thing comes from the ending, and this is definitely spoilers here. And this is interesting, too, because the ending slightly differs depending on if you're playing the English version or the original Japanese version. Mm. They actually partially censored it. It's kind of weird. So basically, Wit and Kles get all four of the gems. They go to the Shrine of Ushas, and the gems have fused together. They insert the gems into the statue of Ushas, and if you are playing the UK version, if you're playing the English version, the screen shakes, it cuts to a view from space of Earth, and it shows kind of a mushroom cloud, and then it just says the end. And you don't know what the hell happened exactly.
Wow.
If you're playing the Japanese version, it actually has a whole text ending after that, which explains that it turns out the actual Shrine of Ushas was an ancient nuclear weapon that was developed by this ancient race, and they realized how dangerous it was, so the key to activate it was split into four pieces and spread among various ruins so that humanity would never accidentally activate it and blow up half the world, which Wit and Kles have gathered those four pieces, put them back together, and activated it, and blew up about a third of the planet and killed themselves in the process. And the ending just literally ends with text that essentially says, like, well, that sucks, doesn't it? Oops. And then that's pretty much it. And it's the best screw you ending I think I've ever seen from a game.
Moral of the story, be careful with those nuclear launch codes.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember they did that in, if anyone's ever seen it, in Turn A Gundam, they did that. They were, because Turn A Gundam is kind of about this plot where, like, it's way, way, way in the future, and the Gundams that they find are, like, ancient technology for them. And at one point in the storyline, the bumbling Earth people found a nuclear bomb and didn't know it was a nuclear bomb, and they're, like, playing catch with it. And, like, the main character is, like, whoa, no, don't do that. And one of the major characters gets killed because they're like playing catch with this nuclear bomb and it blows up. And then so the main character has to take all the other nukes that they found and keep it inside his Gundam wrapped up in hay in like the launch bays so that it won't blow, so that no one else will blow it up.
Because storing nuclear bombs wrapped in hay is, of course, the best way of nuclear disposal.
Yeah. And it becomes like a Chekhov's gun throughout the rest of the series because he's holding on to them. Yeah, but the thing is, like, I think that's actually way more relevant to Ancient Aliens than it seems like, because a lot of the Ancient Aliens stuff is about reinterpreting stuff that's already out there. And if you look at, like, Vedic traditions and things, there's a lot of lore about these wars that the Hindu gods fought, and that what was Vishnu, I think, had like these flying machines called Vimanas, and he had like what essentially sounds like lasers. I mean, they call them like death rays or heat rays or something like that. But if you read the descriptions of very things, he had like a ship that had laser beams, and he'd fly around and he'd shoot at people in laser beams, and they'd get into all these fights with these different cities. And at one point in the story, they use this like, it's described something like a lightning bolt thing of the gods or something like that, but it's basically a nuclear bomb. Like if you go looking, there's evidence that a nuclear bomb was exploded in ancient history in India. Like you can still find like fused sand and stuff, and the descriptions in the ancient traditions of what happened to the people is exactly what happens to people who are suffering from radiation poisoning. Their skin, you know, starts to, for people that are really close, you know, their skin melts. For other people, they start to like burn, and they try to get into the water, and the water, you know, it's essentially poisonous to them, and their skin starts to fall off. And all the stuff that happens with radiation is exactly what was happening in this storyline. But it wasn't described as a nuclear bomb.
Right.
But that's exactly, I mean, that exactly ties into Usha's, because Usha's essentially like, you accidentally put together the ancient bomb that we've been trying to hide for all these years.
As Robert Oppenheimer famously quoted, "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds," from the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah.
Which is part of the Vedic chronicle. Yeah. That's a theme that comes up in Relics, by the way. Relics does kind of piecemeal out this notion that there was a war centered around these ruins, which weren't once ruins. They were once kind of a big ziggurat that people lived in out in this ocean. And so that's why I do think it ultimately does have ancient aliensness to it, because it may be an alternate world, an alien world, but a similar pattern is happening where something that should not have been touched or activated again has now been revived, presumably by the exploration team. It's quite like Quatermass in the Pit, which we mentioned not during the main recording, and how, you know, you have this exploratory team, they come in and they dig the archaeology, and they unleash something, in this case, the ruins rising back up from the ocean, which contain details inside on what happened during the Great War way back then.
Yeah.
Between hell and heaven, those are the two main factions, between aliens and the beasts, the regular beasts of the ruins, so forth. It's kind of similar to that, what you're describing with the Vedic traditions.
And Quatermass of the Pit, for people who don't know what that is a British TV. It was a drama. It was actually a series in a series called, you know, it was Quatermass. It was, I think, four of them produced, maybe five throughout different time periods. But it was a British story. And the Quatermass in the Pit was the third one it was done in. I think it was 1957 or something like that.
The cusp of 1958-59, yeah.
Yeah, so it was live on TV. It was, you know, performed live. And you can find it on YouTube, I think, actually.
Yeah.
And so that's like a really good one, because it also deals with ancient aliens, actually even before Eric von Däniken wrote his book. Mm-hmm. And the premise is that this team of researchers accidentally uncover it, and in the process accidentally unleash something very, very dangerous for humanity. And that actually is an interesting point to go with relics, because, and this I think also goes back to the whole Ridley Scott kind of viewpoint of it, was, which is, that, let's say that ancient aliens did come to this planet and use humanity or alter humanity for their purpose, or even create humanity for their purposes. Who's to say that they didn't also do that on other worlds and other places as well?
Yes.
And so that actually is going to move us into the next game that we're going to talk about, which is Chrono Trigger. And again, spoilers, if you've never played Chrono Trigger, you need to stop listening to this and go play Chrono Trigger, because what is wrong with you?
Yeah, if you've never played Chrono Trigger, like, why are you listening to this podcast? How did you even find out about it?
But if not, you should be fine. Chrono Trigger's very, very penultimate final boss, which is actually revealed very early in the game, which I found very interesting that the game did. I think Chrono Trigger is actually masterful in the piecemeal way that they reveal its storyline, because they reveal its storyline very early, but don't give you enough information to fully understand what's going on, which is great storytelling.
From the moment that you look at the television, the monitor screen in the future period, you know, you've seen the end of the world in 1999, and, you know, suddenly this thing you don't know is called Lavos, but you see Lavos for the first time, you know, you're thinking, what is going on? This is much bigger scale than I came in expecting.
Yeah. And it works backwards from there, slowly giving you more information, more information, more information. And your goals change as you progress too, because you start to realize that what you thought you knew wasn't necessarily correct. But at its core, it is an ancient aliens sort of concept, because even though it's not our Earth, and even though it's not, you know, the same thing in that sense, like there's no places in Chrono Trigger that would relate to our Earth. The concept is the exact same, that on their Earth, on their world, you have millions and millions of years ago. I don't even remember how many millions of years ago the prehistoric times is in that game. It's like 150 million years ago or something like that.
65 million.
65 million. That's right. Okay. This alien creature falls from the sky in this meteoric sort of crash, lands on the Earth of Chrono Trigger, not our Earth, and embeds itself into the Earth's core and goes to sleep. Seemingly goes to sleep. But in reality, what it's doing is it's devouring, I wouldn't say that it's devouring the Earth so much as it's devouring the energy of all humanity. And what it's doing is it's influencing in different ways the progression of humanity so that it can continue to feed and grow. And it's, you know, it's, on a genetic level, it's also changing itself and becoming stronger. So your goal is to defeat this thing and stop the future from getting destroyed. But in doing so, you realize that you also have to sort of try to, as much as possible, impact the past, because this thing's been with us for 65 million years and no one knew it. And that's an interesting concept. It's very much like Quatermass in the Pit or another take on the ancient aliens, which is that it's been there and it's been affecting human evolution and history for all this time without us even knowing about it.
Right.
And Chrono Trigger, like I said, Chrono Trigger has a nearly interesting take on it, because it does have its own world and it's a very interesting world to learn about. And it's a great RPG. It's just a great game in general. I mean, if you've never played Chrono Trigger, you have literally missed out on one of like the pillars of gaming of the past 30 years.
There's a reason Chrono Trigger almost always shows up in people's like top 10 list of best games of all time kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's almost always available in some form as well.
Yeah.
Like I think today you can still go out and get it on, at least you can get it on iPhone. And, you know, iOS or, you know, smartphones if you want to. You can also get it on Steam, I think.
Yes, definitely.
There's a DS version of it that's really good. In fact, I think that's still my favorite version.
If you were to make a Criterion Collection for video games, which hasn't happened for various licensing reasons, Chrono Trigger would be in that collection.
Exactly.
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah.
And, I mean, for good reason. I mean, you think about the game's development. It's well, for one thing, it's Square Enix before there was Square Enix.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because you've got the people that make Final Fantasy coming together with the director of Dragon Quest.
Yeah, you've got Yuji Horii and Hironobu Sakaguchi working together.
Yes.
I mean, that's... Ooh. And Akira Toriyama and...
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Akira Toriyama comes in and does all the, like, the art character designs and that kind of stuff, which is funny because you think of him as like, okay, well, that's Dragon Ball, but it's also Dragon Quest.
Yep.
So it's like you've got the Dragon Quest team and the Final Fantasy team working together to create this epic storyline before Square Enix was even a thing.
And you've got Yasunori Mitsuda basically making his, like, major video game music debut.
Oh, yeah. He's making, like, arguably, like, his magnum opus on his first try.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Which, to be fair, like, he really put in the effort to do it. Like, if you know the stories behind that, he, like, caused himself an ulcer and almost died making that game. Like, they literally had to force him to quit and replaced him for a little bit.
There's a YouTube channel I watch sometimes called NES Complex, and he put up a retrospective on Chrono Trigger that goes into the history of its development, and it's a very fantastic, very well done, like, very well researched piece. Highly recommended. If you want to learn more about the development of Chrono Trigger, I recommend the NES Complex video on it.
Okay.
And if you want to play it, go play it.
Yes, please. Very much so.
Gosh, if you've gotten this far and you haven't played Chrono Trigger...
Thank you for listening to part one of our podcast episode about ancient aliens in games. We have a lot more for you in parts two and three, including games like Evo, Ys, Star Tropics, Illusion of Gaia, and of course, La Mulana. If you really enjoyed this episode, please, please check out more episodes. Go to our YouTube channel. Follow us on Discord and Twitter, and also there is the Patreon, patreon.com/doorsanddungeons, and that will help out immensely because it's a lot of work putting this together, especially when they're doing like 3-hour recordings and getting people together, getting people online, and there's other things behind the scenes as well, and there's streaming costs and all that, so anything you can do really helps out. I really appreciate it, and thank you so much. Please take care.